Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya.
Om namo bhagavate
vasudevaya.
Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya.
Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya.
Maitreya uvacha.
Ityupastiyamano
sau.
Ityupastiyamano
sau. Munibir brahmavadibhihi. Salile swakurakranta. Upadat avitavanim. Maitreya uvacha. Ityupastiyamano sau. Munibir brahmavadibhihi. Salile swakurakranta. Upadat avitavanim. The sage Maitreya said, iti, thus, upastiyamanah, being praised by, asau, Lord Bor, munibihi, by the great sages, Brahmavadibhihi, by the transcendentalists, Salile, on the water, Swakura Akranti, touched by his own hooves, Upadatta, placed, Avita, the maintainer, Avanim, the earth. Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. The sage Maitreya said, the Lord being thus worshipped by all the great sages and transcendentalists, touched the earth with his hooves and placed it on the water. Purport, the earth was placed on the water by his inconceivable potency. The Lord is all-powerful, and therefore he can sustain the huge planets either on the water or in the air as he likes. The tiny human brain cannot conceive how these potencies of the Lord can act. Man can give some vague explanation of the laws by which such phenomena are made possible. But actually the tiny human brain is incapable of conceiving of the activities of the Lord, which are therefore called inconceivable. Yet the frog philosophers still try to give some imaginary explanation. Inconceivable doesn't mean that you can't have any conception. Although the Upanishad states, yato vacho nivartante apropya manasa saha. The absolute truth is described here, that from which all words desist. That means they just give up trying to describe it. Apropya manasa saha, and it cannot be achieved, it cannot be reached by the words that we speak or by the exercise of our mind. That seems to describe an absolute inconceivability. And the impersonalists take that interpretation, literal interpretation of the statement, and they consider that the absolute truth in its pure form cannot be described by any words, because he's nirvishesha. It is nirvishesha. undivided, without qualities. Division, acquiring qualities, means corruption. The absolute truth is corrupted by the acquisition of duality. That's their idea. Duality has to be explained. If you have a philosophy that doesn't explain what everyone sees in front of them, then what's the use of that philosophy? It's just useless play of the mind. A philosophy should try to explain the given facts. Some things, because everybody sees them, must be real in some sense and have to be explained. Duality is something everyone experiences. Although you may want to establish non-duality as the absolute truth, problem is, we've got all this duality to explain away. Especially if your axiom is that the absolute truth in its pure form doesn't have any duality. So where does the duality come from? The absolute truth is pure and perfect. The duality is impure and imperfect. Then where is this duality? What is the substance of it? What is the basis of it? Well, the axiom is janmadyasyoyataha. The absolute truth itself is everything, is the basis of everything. Whatever appears to be real is only the absolute truth. Maybe perceived wrongly, but everything is the absolute truth. There is nothing else. Ekam advitiyam brahma. There is only one reality, Brahman, and nothing else. That's the statement of the Vedas, of the Aitareya Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. So the impersonalists take that literally. There is nothing else beside Brahman. So where does the duality come from? Brahman doesn't suffer duality, or does he? They have to postulate another entity called avidya, illusion, which creates the duality. But upon what is the duality imposed? Upon Brahman. Nothing else exists. It's the Brahman that appears dual. So, this creates a lot of problems for their theory, this postulation of avidya, because it's a second entity, and there isn't supposed to be a second entity. So avidya creates the duality, but fine, why is there a second entity? And who gets deluded? There's nobody else to be deluded but Brahman. So Brahman suffers delusion created by a second entity who isn't supposed to exist. They have to, when we ask them, well, does this avidya exist or not? Is it just nothing? If it's nothing, then how does it do anything? How does nothing have any effect on anything? And if it's something, then you've got another thing separate from Brahman. So they say, no, it's anirvachaniya. Avidya is inexplainable, unexplainable. You cannot say that it either exists or it doesn't exist. That's what they have to resort to explain away this other entity. So there's so many problems involved in trying to establish, in a literal sense, that the absolute truth has no variety, that it's formless and indivisible, literally. And when you try to say that the absolute truth cannot be described in words at all, then what are the Vedas then? Then the Vedas are also Maya, because they're words trying to describe the absolute truth, or at least the Upanishads, or Tato Brahmagigyasa. According to Bhadarayana Vyas, the Upanishads, the purport of the Upanishads, is that we to investigate what is the absolute truth. People may have their various ideas what the Upanishads are, but Vyasadeva's opinion is that the purport of the Vedas is to explain the absolute truth. in words. What are the Vedas but words? So does that violate the statement? So when you have two contradictory, apparently contradictory ideas coming from the same source of evidence, the same pramana is providing, when you have different pramanas, then one is probably can overrule the other. The evidence of Shastra overrules the evidence of logic or of sensory perception. If there's apparent contradiction, then the other two pramanas don't have the priority. Shabda pramana has the priority. But when you have the same one and the same pramana saying two apparently contradictory things, then it's more complicated. You can't reject the source because it's the same source. You can't say one source is less authoritative than the other. It's the same source. The same Upanishads are saying that the absolute truth cannot be described in words, and then describing the absolute truth in words. When you have two apparently contradictory statements coming from the same source, and statements one is coming from Shabda Pramana, two apparently contradictory pieces of evidence, one of them has to be modified to reconcile the two. One of them has to be understood in a modified sense. In a literal sense, they conflict. So one of them has to be understood in a secondary sense, modified sense. The question is, which one? The impersonalists will say that the statement that the absolute truth cannot be described by words has to be taken literally, and any apparent description of the absolute truth in words has to be understood in a modified way, conditional way. Not the real absolute truth, only Saguna Brahman, the reflection of Brahman in Maya, can be described in words. Parameshwara, the supreme person, God, is a reflection in Maya of the absolute truth. He's also Maya. That's why we call them Mayavadis, because they say that Krishna is also Maya. So that's their interpretation. Any statement describing of the Vedas describing the absolute truth in words is not absolute, is not describing the pure absolute truth, but the corrupted absolute truth, the personal form, or the form with qualities at least. Relativizing all the statements that are supposed to be describing the absolute truth as describing not really the absolute truth, something less than the absolute truth. Including practically all the statements of the Upanishads, the whole Vedanta Sutra, beginning with the first sutra, Janmadyasyataha, is describing functional qualities of the absolute truth. He creates the world, he maintains it and destroys it. These are qualities, and not only qualities, but activities. Now, one thing has qualities, but a living thing has activities, more than just static qualities. That's a higher degree of variety. So the absolute truth being described at the very beginning of the Vedanta Sutra and throughout the Vedanta Sutra is an absolute truth that has qualities. According to Shankara's terminology, the Vedanta Sutra is called Sharirika Shastra. Describes the absolute truth with his embodiment, Sharira's body, the embodiment of the absolute truth by his qualities. The absolute truth is the soul, and his qualities, including his personal form, are his body. But that's the Saguna Brahman. So the Vedanta Sutra, which is simply an explanation of the Upanishads, is only talking about Saguna Brahman, basically. And there are a few statements that might be picked out, Mahavakyas, that actually indicate the pure absolute truth. Everything else is just, you know, inconsequential because it's only describing the Saguna Brahman, which is just Maya anyway. So really, in effect, they're degrading the Vedas themselves to just Maya because they're words. Words are a form of duality. Those words can't describe the absolute truth. They can only indirectly point to it. Metaphorically. That's what we do, what we end up with if we take that interpretation. But the principle is that one or the other apparently contradictory statement has to be modified. Why not take the other side and take the one statement rather than have to be in a position where we can't even accept the authority of the Vedas unmodified? We can't take the Vedas in any literal sense. It's all just metaphorical. Rather than modify all the Vedic statements, why not modify this one statement simply? Or those statements that say, similar like this, that the absolute truth cannot be described in words and has no form, no quality. Those statements should be modified, understood in a modified sense. And the Vaishnavacharyas give some simple formulas how to do that. The absolute truth cannot be understood by a materialist, and the words of a materialist are impotent to describe the absolute truth. Or the absolute truth cannot be described completely or understood completely by anybody. Simple. Simple modification of the statement, yato vacho nivartante. Words cease. My words, or the words of a materialist, can't even start to describe the absolute truth. The materialist can only speculate and never really, really describe the absolute truth. And even the greatest devotees, even Ananta Shesha, the personality of Godhead, cannot describe the qualities of the Supreme completely. Because those qualities are ever-increasing, and they're infinite and ever-increasing. That way it's reconciled, if we take the right interpretation. Inconceivable potency. So the Lord is inconceivable, not that nobody can conceive of him at all, but nobody, the materialist cannot conceive of him, and nobody can understand him completely. That's what achincha means. Not completely ineffable, just like they talk about, the Mayavadis talk about avidya as anirvachaniya. You can't say anything about avidya. You can't say it exists or it doesn't exist. What kind of logic is that? You know, a thing either exists or it doesn't. Don't tell me that I can't say it, that one or the other isn't true. This is simply the law of logic. Either yes or no. There's no third position. The Jains try to make a complicated logic that every fact is not just yes or no. Every statement is not just right or wrong. It's right, wrong, maybe. And then they have seven state logic. You know? Seven different possibilities. What is this? Either yes or no, either true or false. Every statement is like that. The Maya, avidya, either exists or it doesn't exist. Either it's something or it's nothing. There's no third position. It's not just limitation of language. That's reality. Something exists or it doesn't exist. So, the absolute truth is inconceivable, achintya, not in the sense that you can't know anything about it, but you can't know everything about it. You cannot reduce the understanding of the relationship between God and his energies just by explanations, by logical analysis. You can explain something, but you can't explain everything. Therefore, there's always an inconceivable element. And therefore, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu designated his philosophy as achintya bheda bheda. The absolute truth is non-dual and also dual, and how he's both the same and different from his energies, that we cannot fully explain. We can give some explanation, but you can't reduce it to just logical terms. It goes beyond logic. Or the potencies, the relationship between the Lord and the potencies can never be fully explained. So by his inconceivable potency, that nobody can explain, that the materialists can try to speculate about, but because they're faithless, they just reject it as a fable anyway. That Lord Varaha actually did this. That he actually empowered the earth to float on the ocean. But God has done that. The planets are floating in space. This Adhara Shakti is a fact. It's something that we all perceive. Why doesn't the Earth just fall into the sun? Of course, you can explain it. You can make Prabhupada that very nice sentence here, which reduces all the endeavors of science over the last hundreds of years, or thousands of years, to just a very silly attempt. He says, man can give some vague explanation of the laws by which such phenomena are made possible. That's it. That's everything that's been accomplished by science, all the millions of PhD dissertations, and all the discoveries. It's just an attempt to make a vague explanation. Nothing much more. Very vague. So many laws are discovered and described and reduced to mathematical terms. But it's a vague explanation. You can explain in some sort of physical terms, giving mathematical equations, to show why the Earth doesn't fall into the sun. Because the centripetal and centrifugal forces are matching, and the Earth therefore stays in its orbit. But why do they match? Why is the Earth just the right distance from the sun? Why isn't it a little closer? In which case it would be too hot to sustain life. Why isn't it a little further? In which case it would be too cold to sustain life. A little bit, 1%, 1.5%, either direction, further or closer. And life would be finished. A little bit out of balance, and everything's destroyed. What keeps the balance? What created the balance? What put the Earth in the right place? Or even more important, that might have been just accident. You know, billions of planets, and one of them happens to fall in the right place. What keeps it in the right place? This is the real question. The question of maintenance, you know, creation might just be by accident. Big bang, everything just falls down, and some things fall down in the right place. But the question of maintenance, that really demands a search for some organizing force, intelligence or something else, if you can come up with something other than conscious intelligence that would keep things in order. Things are in order. They may have supposedly been created by an explosion, everything just fell down. But where is this exquisite and complex order coming from? Life is such a complex phenomena. How does it happen just by accident? Maybe you can actually, Sataputtaprabhu and others have shown that statistically it's very unlikely that life evolved just by chance. The odds are way too great. That complex, even the simplest one-celled organism, you know, could have evolved over the course of only 3 billion years and by chance. What to speak of a human body? So complex. The eye has a nerve that goes back into the brain. That nerve, during the development of the embryo, actually starts growing from the brain and reaches the eye. It's like digging a tunnel through thousands of miles of dense rock, you know, mountain, and just exactly coming out in the right spot. You start digging from the other side, and it's got to come out exactly the same, you know, because you've already built the railway at the meeting point on the other side. Your tunnel has to come out on the right, at the right, exactly right point. After digging a tunnel thousands of miles long, you have to come out, you know, within a few millimeters of the right spot to meet the rails on the other side. That's accomplished by whatever is organizing the development of the embryo manages to send this nerve to the eyeball so that it reaches it, you know, through all the brain tissue. Did that evolve by accident? Were there so many cases of mistakes, you know, of optic nerves that developed ending up in the wrong place, attached to the ear instead, or going nowhere? And, you know, one out of 20 zillion turned out to be the right one, and that one survived? Very unlikely. Yes? Yeah, then you got so many, you know, useless people having to, you know, look with their ears. It's very unlikely. It's just mathematically out of the question, statistically out of the question, that such complex life forms as the ones, as the kind of body we're living in, with all its complex organs and functions, could evolve by chance. There must be something beyond chance, something undoing the law of chance, and in a sense, an organizing principle. That's intelligence, living conscious intelligence. And whose intelligence is it? These are the real philosophical questions. The attempt to just analyze the phenomena in terms of physical laws is only a vague explanation of reality. To get a real proper picture of why things happen, why they actually happen. Why means two things. What made it happen? And for what purpose does it happen? Two different questions. You know, what produced the living organism, the human body? What actually made it happen? What organized it? Who made the design? And who did the engineering? That's one question. The other question is, what purpose does it serve, this human body? These are questions that are not answered by philosophical speculation or so-called hard science, which is also speculation. Just it has some grounding in real facts. And on the basis of real facts and good mathematics, you can derive some conclusions, some vague conclusions about what's going on, some general conclusions. But the real understanding of why, how did it come about, and what purpose does it serve, that can only be understood through Shabda Pramana, Vedic knowledge. Therefore, when the Absolute Truth is called inconceivable, we're left with doubt that maybe there's no sense trying to understand the Absolute Truth if it's inconceivable. But then Vyasadeva says, Shastra Yoni Tvat. The Absolute Truth can be understood. But the only way to know the Absolute Truth is through the Vedic Shastra. Tam Tvau Panishidam Purusham Pichachami. Bhrigu Muni inquired, I want to know about that Supreme Person who is understood through the Upanishads. Through the Upanishads, through the Vedas, through the Bhagavatam, which is explaining this Vedic knowledge to us, we can understand the Absolute Truth through the process of Shabda Pramana. Inconceivable doesn't mean we can't know at all. We can know well enough to perfect our lives, to serve all our purposes. We can know everything we need to know about the Absolute Truth. But we have to receive that knowledge from the transcendental source of divine Shabda Pramana. Anyway, that's the message here. Any questions or comments? Yes, ma'am.
Is the earth still on the Gavadakusha? Is it like it's pretty
much? No, it's above. I mean, there's the Buraloka is maintained some, I don't remember how many, hundreds of thousands of yojanas above. Above the, you know, the bottom of the universe, it's in the upper half. Yeah. The Garbhodaka Ocean is the lower half, yeah. And the Earth system is some distance above. Below the Earth system are the Patala Lokas. They're also above the Garbhodaka Ocean, and then above the Earth are other planets. So there's you know, it's some degree, some amount of space above that ocean.
So is it kind of figurative when you say that he placed it in the water?
No, at that time, he did. You know, prior to putting the earth in its proper place, he put her down. Now, why did he put her down? That's that story we hear in the retelling, or the elaborate telling that includes the encounter with the demon Hiranyaksha. He put the earth down because he had a fight with the demon. Okay, that's told. You know, we read it again in chapter 16 or 17, or 18, whatever it is, about the fight, that he put the earth down and gave her the potency to float because he had to put her aside to fight the demon.
Right.
Of course, in some of Varaha's appearances, there is no demon to fight. He just delivers the earth.
Which means he just puts it in all the...
Maybe he doesn't put her down in those pet leelas. Here Maitreya has combined two different appearances of Varadev.
Right.
So, you know, I don't know which are the separate elements of each appearance. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know if when Varaha appears and doesn't find any demon, whether he does put the earth down. I don't know. Yeah.
So who made the earth sink?
I don't know the story. We'd have to look at some other Puranas about what's going on. There's some other circumstance, but I don't know what it is.
Yeah. You mentioned about this, my wife hearing of Vidya as a separate entity. So we don't accept that it also comes from Brahma, because Brahma is the source of everything.
Well, then, it is Brahman. If it comes from Brahman, it is Brahman. And so, duality is arising in Brahman, and it's not supposed to. Avidya has to be separate, because duality is not supposed to manifest in Brahman. It has to manifest in something else. So they create something, they imagine there's something else, this avidya. But if that something else exists, then Brahman isn't a one without a second. There's a second. So they can't allow avidya to actually exist.
And what about that everything comes from Brahman? Brahman is the source of everything.
Yes. So really, Brahman should be the source of avidya too. Otherwise, the statement that Brahman is the source of everything isn't true. Their theory just doesn't hold together. The Vaishnavas have a great time tearing it apart hundreds of ways. You know, Mayavad Shata Dushani. So many books have been written by Vaishnavacharyas ripping apart to shreds this theory because it just doesn't stand. We can boldly tell the Mayavadis their theory doesn't work and show how. They're so foolish they can't understand, you know, what we're saying, but it's very straightforward. Their theory is just inconsistent. But they have all sorts of tricks. Our, like, host in Benares, not my host, the professor he sent me to, made a comment. Had nothing to do with what I was discussing with him. That so many people, I guess that includes all the Vaishnavacharyas, misunderstand Shankaracharya when he calls the earth, creation mithya. And supposedly he explains, or he's not him, but his disciple explains what mithya really means. Mithya doesn't mean false, but it means temporary, that has a beginning, whatever, because some shastra is quoted that says what has a beginning and end is mithya. Really, what that statement says is that what is mithya has a beginning and an end. Everything that's false, you know, this duality, world of duality, everything in the world of duality has a beginning and end. It's not really an essential definition of what mithya means. Mithya means false. Anyway, this professor was saying, look, Shankaracharya really doesn't mean that mithya means false. He means that it means temporary. But he didn't just use the word mithya. He developed an elaborate philosophy explaining how all duality is not real. You know, he said so many other ways, even without the word mithya, that everything that's dual is not ultimately real, and it's only apparently real. So, anyway, it's just, you know, word jugglery. Even if Shankaracharya didn't mean mithya to really mean false, he said that this world is false in so many other ways, in so many other words. So they have so many tricks. Yeah. They just can't accept defeat. They're just not honest, these Mayavadis.
Is it as
prominent as it was? Is there a lot of Advaitis? It's all pervading. The influence of the Mayavad philosophy, maybe not directly, because people don't even know the original philosophy. And because of this development of what so-called Neo-Vedanta.
Neo-Vedanta?
Yeah, the 19th century Bengalis and others, these people like Vivekananda and these other, all these other, you know, people coming up with their Mayavad versions, all these modern philosophies, they're not really based properly on an understanding of what Shankara taught. They just, you know, they're just wild concoctions. So they're not really even you know, proper Mayavadis, because they don't even know the, you know, their founder Acharya's philosophy. You know, they claim to be following Shankara, but they're not even following Shankara. They're just making up some you know, nonsense. Because of that confusion, the direct influence of Shankara has been diminished, because nobody even understands anymore. Nobody even properly understands. Maybe they read, but they don't understand what he actually said. The theory he actually proposed. But the influence is all pervading. Even though they don't even properly follow or properly understand what Shankara taught, his influence is—he's conquered the world. In India, almost everybody is strongly influenced by Mayavad ideas, by the basic ideas that everything is one, that personality is illusion, that, you know, ultimately the absolute truth is not a person. This is almost everybody's influenced by this idea, even the so-called Vaishnavas. Many of them have got this impersonal, this Mayavad contamination in their hearts and in their brains. And it comes out of their mouth when they talk. They're worshipping God with the aim to get liberation and go beyond this worship of God, to merge with God. They worship Krishna to merge with him, to become Krishna. Even many Vaishnavas are like that. Worshippers of Krishna, of Vishnu. They're worshipping Vishnu, but with the aim of liberation, with the aim of impersonal liberation. There are, because they've been infected by Mayavad misunderstanding. Even though they're engaged in the worship of Vishnu, they're thinking that the ultimate perfection is to become one with Vishnu.
Even Sampradaya?
Yes.
Really?
Yes. Although the Sri Sampradaya and the Madhva Sampradaya are relatively free from this contamination. They're pretty strict. But others, you know, there are other minor sampradayas that have cropped up. You know, especially all these medieval bhakti movements. The founders of these movements and the followers are very strongly influenced by Mayavad. These Ramanandis and the Kabir and the Tulsidasas, they're all strongly influenced by Mayavad ideas. Okay. Hare Krishna. Anyway, thing is, most of the people in India today are not following. There may be, you know, okay, there are Sri Vaishnavas. There are a lot of Sri Vaishnavas. Some of them are influenced by Mayavad. Prabhupada found out when he went to visit Tirupati that they were instituting, was it Tirupati? Yeah, they were instituting this Panchopasana in the Tirupati temple. You know, Shankaracharya's system of worshipping five different kinds of demigods. Ramanujacharya would never tolerate that, or any of his proper followers. So that contamination has reached even the Sri Vaishnavas to some extent. But the thing is, statistically, most of the people in India are not following these orthodox sampradayas. They're following some, you know, some made-up sampradaya that is actually strongly influenced by Mayavad ideas, even though they claim to be Vaishnavas. Hare Krishna. That's why I don't like all this stuff coming out of the loudspeakers, because it's mostly being, you know, broadcast by gross materialists and Mayavadis.
Right.
Yeah.
Even it's like
Bhagavad. Yeah, all this katha that they're cramming down our throats. It's mostly coming from, you know, materialists who have no qualification to be speaking these things, or and people who are influenced by Mayavad ideas.
Mm-hmm.
Hare Krishna. You have a comment? Okay, should we wrap it up? Thank you, all glory to Srila Prabhupada.
No.
Okay. All glory to Srila Prabhupada, Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai.